This is the weekend edition of the Daily Gold Podcast, covering precious metals and global capital markets for intelligent investors. Now, here is your host, Jordan Roy Byrne.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Daily Gold Podcast. Today we are interviewing a new guest. He's Worth Ray, the chief economist at Evergreen GAFCAL, and he's also the author of a recent book on China. Bear with me, has a long title. It's called A Great Leap Forward, Making Sense of China's Cooling Credit Boom, Technological Transformation, High Stakes Rebalancing, Geopolitical Rise, and Reserve Currency Dream. And the book was published last summer, brilliantly timed. I mean, keep in mind, when people write books, they're working on them in advance. It's not like I could just publish them in a week, but the book came out literally at the point when China's equity market started to collapse. And Worth, how are you doing today? It's great to have you on.
Doing great. Glad to be here with you, Jordan.
Yeah, and so the first thing I want to get into, China, of course, and with respect to a time frame of 12 months, let's say, is the biggest problem in China their slowing economy or their declining currency, and how might those things affect the U.S. economy and U.S. capital markets?
Sure. So these things are intimately connected. What I can tell you is that China's economy isn't collapsing outright, like some people are saying, but it is slowing. It's been slowing for a long time, but the public is just kind of starting to wake up to that in the West. The real problem here is that China's gone on one of the most, you know, epic credit binges in modern history. It's actually the third greatest credit binge on record. You know, in between 2008 and 2013, credit growth expanded by more than 75% in that five-year period. That puts it third to, you know, Ireland and Spain historically. And what we know is that in China, the numbers are kind of dramatically understated likely. So, you know, it could be even worse. When you see that kind of a credit expansion, the IMF has told us that within a few years of credit cooling, you always, always at these extreme levels see either a collapse or a stagnation. Now, China has a lot of tools to deal with that problem. It has a lot of tools to backstop bad debts in the system. But I do believe that non-performing loan rates are very high. They're underreported. They're not acknowledged. But, you know, it's a very similar situation to what you saw in the 1990s, where high credit growth in the early 90s led to a non-performing loan rate that Beijing admitted to about 30% by the early 2000s. It really might have been more like 50. Today, similar credit growth rates, they say that non-performing loans are 1.6%. So why does this matter? It means that there's a ton of bad debt lodged in China's financial system, and the People's Bank of China is having to inject cash into that financial system to keep it liquid. Since their capital account is partially open, meaning that money can flow in and out to an extent, what they're doing is basically trying to challenge the impossible trinity. You know, we know economies have a choice, or governments have a choice, to have, you know, a stable exchange rate, a open free flow of capital in their economy, or they can have a monetary policy autonomy. But they can't have all three. They can only choose two. And so at this point, they've been trying to defy that. If they're going to keep pumping liquidity in the system to deal with bad debts, and if they're going to keep their capital account open, meaning that money can still flow out, they're going to have more outflows. And if they're going to have more outflows, they're going to have a very difficult time keeping that currency stable. I think this is the biggest risk for the global economy where we are right now. And, you know, what I'm seeing is the People's Bank of China losing credibility, Beijing losing credibility overall. Investors in China, you know, locals having to deal with credit risks for the first time, currency risk for the first time in decades. And the result is that people are starting to vote with their feet. You know, so far, the outflows out of China have been a function of, you know, refinancing dollar debts back into renminbi, of, you know, speculative carry trades unwinding. But now you're seeing residents leave. And, you know, the problem is that Beijing's ability to defend the currency is very limited. So if you look at their foreign exchange reserves, $3.3 trillion officially at the end of December, that's the biggest in the world. It looks unchallengeable. And except that that number was, you know, roughly 29% of China's domestic money supply in 2008. It's less than 16 today. Compare that to Southeast Asian economies in the, you know, late 1990s and the Asian financial crisis. They had over 20% in many cases. So Beijing simply does not have the resources to defend its currency while it's also being forced to keep its banks liquid. Now, look, there's been a lot of bank injections over the course of the last few weeks. This is largely seasonal because of what you're seeing around the Lunar New Year. A lot of people want cash this time, and they tend to pull out of the banks. After we get through Lunar New Year, I think what we could see, though, is that the People's Bank of China has to keep putting money in the banks, and that continues and becomes more of a long-term thing. So this isn't going away. I don't believe that Beijing can defend the renminbi for terribly longer, maybe the rest of this year, maybe into next year if they make some very difficult political choices. But their options are limited. Their time is running out. And if they do what's smart, they're going to float the renminbi from a position of strength today. You know, because of all those bad loans in the system, because of all that debt, you know, Beijing can engineer a stagnation, but it can't, you know, give itself fantastic, healthy growth going forward. That's a huge political problem. It's a threat to the Chinese Communist Party's continued rule. And so if they have any hope of working their way out of this, they need to execute on a plan called One Belt, One Road. It's a plan to connect China to Europe and also reinvigorate the old spice routes that stretched across South Asia and the South China Sea, the Indian Ocean, up to Africa, up through to the Mediterranean. If they can reestablish, you know, these trade routes through modern day, you know, road and rail and pipeline and cable and airport and, you know, seaport infrastructure, then that plan may be able to help them boost their growth long term by moving up the value chain, creating demand for the kind of products they want to sell, and it may help them escape. If they don't float the renminbi soon, then they're going to run out of their options for accomplishing that goal. And a little longer term, we should be worried about a real economic collapse in China. We're not there yet. Where we are now, though, is that if the renminbi goes, we're talking about a very big deflationary shock on the rest of the world, a big catalyst for further competitive devaluation by the Japanese, the Europeans, and a lot of other countries around the world that are affected. You're talking about hard downsides for commodities, you know, a big rip in the U.S. dollar. It could very well bring on a financial crisis, but it's difficult to predict financial crises in advance. You never know quite what's going to bring it on. I can tell you, though, relative to history, that if you look at what's happening with the renminbi, that historically, or look at what's happening with the world, you've historically had very sharp financial shocks with economies, with a global economy that was less interconnected, that was less levered, where emerging markets that were the source of the shock made up a much smaller share of global debt to GDP. You even had a country like Thailand, who, you know, was the shock in 1997 that unleashed hell. And everyone said Thailand's a small, interconnected economy. They don't have meaningful trade or financial linkages. Nothing bad can happen here. We know what happened. And it happened because of herding behavior. So, you know, if the renminbi goes, a lot of the money that's gone out seeking returns in places it didn't belong could come slamming back. You could get big rallies in U.S. treasuries. You could get a big rally in the dollar. That could be a very negative risk environment. But it could also be a reset for the global economic system, and the world on the other side would be very different. It's not all bad, but we have to be aware of the risks.
Now, just a quick follow-up on that with regards to the renminbi. I mean, is this decision to float it or not? I mean, is this something that could be a couple weeks or a couple months away, or would this be something that we'd anticipate in the second half of the year?
You know, it could happen anytime. And that's the difficult thing about 2016, you know. You know, you think about the renminbi, it's kind of like a knife that's hanging over the market's heads from a fraying string of twine. You know, anything can push this kind of over the edge. Beijing can make that political decision at any point. I should point out, Beijing is not in a position right now where they're being forced to float the renminbi. You know, they still have over $3 trillion in foreign exchange reserves. They out of that, you know, at least $2 trillion of it is liquid and available to defend the currency. So they can certainly drag this on for longer. And I should also point out, they have supposedly, if the numbers are accurate, and I'm not convinced they are, but if the numbers are accurate, they also have a trade surplus of about $600 billion. So if you think about this as a, like a leaky bucket, you know, the faucet pouring in the top of the budget is their trade surplus. So they're adding $600 billion to their FX reserves every year while they're losing a tremendous amount out the bottom. You know, the trade surplus didn't save them from losing $500 billion off of their foreign exchange reserves last year. So, you know, that isn't a cure-all. This is not the same situation as Thailand or Malaysia or Indonesia in the late 90s or Mexico in 1994, but it is a situation where Beijing is starting to run through resources that it needs if it's going to make an economic transition in the future where Beijing and the Chinese Communist Party stays in power. They may make the decision to go, and the smart thing would be for them to do it soon. So, you know, Chinese New Year is coming up. Families in China right now are, you know, in the middle of one of the biggest human migrations that happens every year from, you know, cities and urban areas back to their families in rural areas in China. And this is a time where, like I mentioned, liquidity runs low, so the People's Bank of China normally intervenes, but, you know, business kind of shuts down. This would be a really interesting time for Beijing to do it if they're going to. So I do think we have to be on watch for a renminbi float in the next couple of weeks around Chinese New Year. But I would just be aware that this isn't necessarily going to happen immediately. We can't predict the timing because that's up to political decisions made in Beijing. We really don't know exactly what Beijing's thinking because they're communicating in such an opaque way. I mean, you're getting different messages out of a lot of groups. But that's the communication kind of pattern that you see before these kinds of decisions. You know, you'll have a decision where, you know, a situation where central bank says, no, we're not going to float the currency. We would never do that. And 15 minutes later, they do. So, you know, this could happen at any point, and it's going to be a risk that we have to deal with as we go forward with the year. You know, if you look at the U.S. economy, the U.S. may be rolling into recession. It may prove to be a soft patch, but, you know, we could start working through this and find that just as the U.S. is starting to look okay again, this hits and it sends us into a really negative risk environment that really a lot of people didn't expect. So it's a very sharp, pronounced risk. It's not something we can time well, but it is something we absolutely have to respect.
And let me move to currencies, and let's talk about the U.S. dollar. I mean, I know that you follow the U.S. dollar index and the trade-weighted index. I mean, just this week we saw the dollar index failed to break out, had a bit of reversal. I mean, precious metals had a huge week. We'll get to that later. But you obviously don't think this is some major bearish turning point for the U.S. dollar. And I was going to say explain your reasoning, but I know a lot of it has to do with China. Is there anything else you can add to that?
No, there's a lot I can add, and you're right. I don't think that this is a big reversal in the dollar trend. What I can tell you is the dollar is not just driven by the Federal Reserve, and there's a lot more reasons to think it can get stronger here, not just China. So, you know, if you look at what's happened in the U.S. dollar, the trade-weighted dollar bottomed in 2011, and it's been rising ever since. It didn't really take off, though, until 2014. So in 2014, you had a situation where the Fed had begun to taper back its QE, which I believe is absolutely tightening on the economy. We started to see the dollar rise, credit spreads rise, financial conditions deteriorate from mid-2014 on. And that has been a big driver in the dollar. However, you've also seen central bank policy around the world outside of the U.S. drive it a lot further up as well. The Bank of Japan surprised on Halloween in 2014 with a big unexpected expansion in its QE. The European Central Bank came through in early 2015 with a big expansion in QE. These actions both significantly added to dollar strength. And it's important because you're now at a moment where, yes, the dollar took a big drop down this week when it became clear that the gap between the ISM manufacturing PMI and the ISM non-manufacturing PMI, basically measures of manufacturing and service activity in our economy, those started to snap shut just like alligator jaws. You know, manufacturing had been falling off, you know, pretty harshly in recent months, and it's now been contracting for 4 months in a row. But the services activity of the U.S. economy was looking fairly robust. Now you're starting to see services activity decelerate in a very sharp way that you only really see before recessions. So there's this question of, is the Fed going to hike any interest rates anymore? And the market said, you know, no, we don't think so, and reacted as if, well, then the dollar should trade down, then it doesn't deserve to be strong. But look, what you're also seeing are currency strength in Japan and in the Eurozone. The euro has strengthened back up to about 112. The yen has strengthened to about 116 versus the dollar. These are really important exchange rates. And the stronger that the yen and the euro both get, the more pressure it puts on those economies. And I'd remind you that, you know, Japan has a tremendous public debt problem, over 240% debt to GDP and its government debt. It cannot afford an environment where it goes back into deflation and it becomes more crushing. In Europe, you're seeing a collapse of the Schengen zone, the agreement that allowed a free flow of people across the Eurozone. The refugee crisis is an absolute nightmare. It's causing political separation to come up in the Eurozone, even as you're seeing economic activity kind of improve. And because of years of negative interest rates, you're starting to see the underpinnings of a legitimate banking crisis in Europe. So problems are bad there. Those central banks have to ease. And even though, you know, them fighting to ease and weaken their currencies here would likely just be incremental moves up for the dollar, all of that puts pressure on the Chinese and accelerates maybe that decision to float. So it's all connected. I would tell you that the Fed policy is important on the dollar, but what happens abroad is important too. Anything that puts pressure on the renminbi makes a big dollar rally in the future all the more likely if a renminbi float does happen. But if the U.S. goes into recession, let me just point out that if you look at the last two recessions, the U.S. dollar continued to rise, or in the case of 2008, where it had been falling, it absolutely spiked into that recession. The dollar tends to strengthen during periods of recession. It doesn't tend to sell off, and a lot of people think that. One of the things we know is that the dollar is likely to go up if the U.S. goes into recession, and it's not likely to turn around right when the Fed announces a new easing package. So, yeah, look, if the Fed is going to do a $5 trillion QE package in the middle of a recession, I'm sure that'll lead to a sharp turn in the dollar. However, I don't think that's what you're likely to see. I think they're likely to dip a toe in. I think they'll probably give you softer language for a while until it becomes really clear in a recession. Then they'll go to negative interest rates and they'll see if that works. And if that doesn't work, they're going to have to go to QE. Once they get behind the curve on the dollar in this next recession, if, you know, conditions around the world are as weak as they are, and I think they would be in the wake of a renminbi float, it's going to be very difficult for the Fed to get back in control. So I don't think this trend is dead. I think it has a tremendous way to run. I just don't think the Fed is going to be the main driver of it going forward.
Okay, now let's take that and transition to precious metals and gold especially, because I know because of your analysis you've been cautious on gold, but at the same time I know you're a long-term bull. You tweeted something right before we got on here, and you said, gotta stay humble on the yellow metal. Correlation between U.S. dollar and gold could absolutely break in the next crisis. Do you want to expound upon that and give your thoughts on gold?
Yeah, I'd be glad to. So, you know, right now what we're seeing is, you know, a negative correlation between gold and the dollar. And you're not seeing it in the past couple of weeks here. That's, you know, showing signs that maybe gold's on the rise and maybe things should be improving. But, you know, when the dollar surges in a big way, I think you're likely to see gold sell off pretty violently. I think gold could go down, you know, as much as 30% in the event of, you know, a global kind of deflationary liquidation. And you saw that kind of an environment in 2008, for example. So gold can definitely take a hit. It's not always going to act like a safe haven. especially in times when there's a lot of forced selling and forced selling by sovereign wealth funds, for example, around the world, or liquidation of foreign exchange reserves, gold can get slammed. However, well, the one thing I would tell you is that faith in central bankers is brittle, and we're going into an environment where they really may start to lose credibility. You're going in into an environment where if the longer China goes and the longer the Saudis go, but as long as they go without breaking their pegs and floating their currencies, if they're liquidating their foreign exchange reserves to defend, what that means is there's a lot of structural demand for things like U.S. treasuries that are being destroyed. And in a panic environment, you're going to likely see that set off or offset by demand by investors for treasuries, for the safe haven of treasuries. However, at some point in this crisis, it's possible that if there's enough FX reserve liquidation and there's enough forced selling by sovereign wealth funds, that you could get in a situation where treasuries don't give you the kind of diversification you would normally expect in a crisis. They hold still, maybe, and then really break down after the crisis calms. And in that kind of environment, it's difficult to predict. It's difficult to know in advance, but it's very possible that gold could be one of the early signs of a psychological change in the markets, and gold could start to run very aggressively before the crisis is even over. And that would be an interesting moment. So, you know, one of the key decisions I think that a lot of investors have to make, or one of the things they need to watch for as we work through this macro environment, is you need to watch treasury rates, treasury yields, see how they behave, see what happens during big bouts of risk aversion. Do treasuries, you know, go to all-time lows? Do they rally as aggressively as they did in times like 08, times like 2011? I think that that's something important. If they kind of hold steady and look a little lethargic, if you're seeing big FX reserve or sovereign wealth liquidation, it could be a sign that structural demand is getting destroyed and that the treasury market is getting off balance. And in that kind of an environment, gold may be kind of the next safe haven substitute. So even though I think it gets hit, I am optimistic, and I think going into the next cycle, it's something I want to own. Since this is difficult to manage, I personally have a view that it makes sense for investors to have at least 5% in gold. You never know what's going to happen, and these things are difficult to time. So, you know, I would own some, but I would maybe load up as we move through this crisis into the next cycle.
So you're saying like 5% now, possibly increase that. And I mean, you're talking from a balanced point of view. I mean, this is our audience is obviously, you know, we're heavy. Tend to be heavy gold investors, but you're talking to a more balanced, diversified portfolio. Not the kind of people who can, you know, afford to move money around quickly and that sort of thing.
Yeah, what I'm saying is that gold can be very difficult to get your hands on when it's finally time to own. So even though I'm looking at the world from this perspective that I expect gold to sell off, and I think that it could take quite a hit over the course of the next year or so. The minimum allocation that I think it's smart to have is 5, and you know you can always grow that. That's based on someone who's telling you, I think this is going down 30%. I wouldn't get rid of all your gold. So from where I'm coming from, I actually think that's quite a statement about what gold can do for a portfolio, how difficult it is to get your hands on it when it's time, and the fact that that confidence and trust in central bankers is very brittle, and when it breaks, you want to have some already.
Now, in that liquidation type environment, how would you expect commodities and equities, both U.S. equities and global equities, to perform?
Oh, goodness. So, you know, this is an environment where global equities likely really struggle. Now, you've already seen, you know, very poor performance in, you know, a lot of emerging markets, but we're seeing signs that emerging market equities are starting to break. You know, you've seen a collapse in the Chinese market last year. I think that's going to continue. you know, I think that that if the Bank of Japan does not get back in control, if it doesn't sacrifice the yen to save Japan from a stronger deflationary crisis, then, you know, you're going to see Japanese equities fall hard. If the Europeans don't respond in time, you're going to see European equities fall hard. There's a bunch of different scenarios for how this can play out, but, you know, global equities are certainly at risk in this environment. But I also think that U.S. equities are at risk in this environment. I mean, right now, it looks as if we may be starting to see a divergence or a break in the correlation between the U.S. dollar and U.S. equities. So just like they did from the, you know, mid-90s up until the year 2000, 2001, you know, U.S. stocks and the dollar have shown a remarkable correlation from 2011 to today. But it looks like it's breaking. And we're seeing a lot of signs that the U.S. equity market may be going into a bear market as we speak, while I think that the dollar is headed higher. So if that's true, this is an environment that may be good for treasuries. If the Chinese go now instead of liquidating their reserves, it could be very good for treasuries. If they liquidate more reserves over time and you see a lot of structural demand that goes away, maybe not. It could be a very good environment for cash as you wait and you see a lot of risk assets decline and then get to buy in at much lower valuations. That makes all the sense in the world. It's not likely going to be a positive environment at all for commodities. And I do think that that downside is a lot more pronounced. Gold is that one commodity, though, where even though I think it will fall victim to some of the same pressures, I think you could see, you know, like I mentioned, gold come out and reflect this psychological change among market participants. And in that situation, you know, gold is something that could perform very well through that crisis. So, you know, having some gold makes sense. Having some cash here makes sense. Having U.S. treasuries makes sense. I recommend doing that within the context of a balanced portfolio where you still own some equities, you still own some commodity type exposure, you still own some credit. But, you know, if you're going to make this in terms of a more directional call, like I know some of your listeners are, I would say this is a time to be defensive, whatever you think that looks like.
Right, and just a quick follow-up on the gold, on the 30% figure you're talking about. I just want to know, I mean, is that just like a guess on your part, or is there something concrete that leads you to that estimate?
Well, you know, I think that the technicals could certainly bring you down, you know, in the 800, 850 kind of range. But, you know, I think that the kind of environment that we're talking about here, if it's extreme, and, you know, we don't know exactly what it's going to look like in the moment. But if it's extreme, you could get some overshooting. And in that environment, you know, I think you could get down into the, say, $750 an ounce range. So, you know, the technicals, I think, would bring us so far down in terms of what that break would look like if it happened. But, you know, if I count for some overshooting and what the risk environment could look like, that could get us a bit lower. I can't be entirely precise in terms of how this performs, though. Gold is, out of all the asset classes that I'm looking at, the one that has me scratching my head the most, because you're ultimately trying to predict when the psychological change in terms of trust in central bankers is going to change. You're also trying to understand what happens to real interest rates in that kind of an environment. And that's largely a function of predicting, you know, how does the Fed respond and when. Those are both really difficult to call. But until you get those two things changing, I think that that gold does have downside.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's so difficult to get a handle on. I mean, I thought it was definitely going to go down this week, and it went way up, and that's from a guy who's following it as closely as anyone.
Yeah.
But, Worth, as we end here, I want to thank you for coming on, and also, can you tell our listeners how they can follow your work exactly?
Yeah, absolutely. So you can follow me on Twitter. My Twitter handle is at Worth Ray. That's WORTHWRAY. I'm also the chief economist at Evergreen GavCal, which is an investment firm in Bellevue, Washington. And you can go to our website, evergreengavcal, that's GAVEKAL.com. Look at our blog, and all of my work, you know, that I've written over the last 7 months or so is listed there. There's a lot that our firm has put out in terms of, you know, the risk of the U.S. equity market, the outlook for the dollar, the risks that the renminbi poses, what we think could happen with different commodity markets, our views on the oil markets, our views on the credit markets. We're kind of spanning the whole thing. So that is free for public consumption. We'd love for you to check it out. And if y'all have questions, just shoot me a note on Twitter.
All righty. Well, thanks so much for coming on, Worth. Fantastic analysis. Really enjoyed it. I'm sure our listeners will. And hopefully we can have you back again.
Thanks, Jordan. Sounds great. Anytime.